So thank you very much. It's a privilege, certainly, to be speaking on the morning that the Fields Medal was awarded for work on the sort of subjects to be discussing. Though, of course, some theoretical physicists like me and others have been working on this subject for a long time, and though I should say it's only with the recent approach due to the mathematicians working on stochastic Lerner evolution and related ideas that I think that we've only started to begin to understand what we were doing. This talk is going to be mainly about this from the conformal field theory point of view, and it's going to be a very introductory talk, perhaps aimed at the mathematicians more in the audience, trying to explain what conformal field theory is. At least the first half of it will be an explanation of the basics of conformal field theory, and in particular explaining what the role of the stress tensor or the stress energy tensor is in that theory. So it's going to be a very basic conformal field theory, where such exotic things like the zero algebra, etc., are only going to be mentioned in a tangential way. And then in the second part of this talk, after I think a short break to allow those of you to escape who want to, I'm going to describe some recent work where we try to understand how to identify the stress tensor in these mathematical theories of random planar curves like SLE. And so the basic idea here is that conformal field theory, or at least some aspects of conformal field theory, and these modern ideas, so CFT in 2D, I should stress, and modern ideas like SLE and related ideas, are both attempting to describe different aspects of the same thing, which is basically the scaling limit. Scaling limit, that's the continuum limit, basically, of two-dimensional critical stat-mech models. So when you think of a two-dimensional critical stat-mech model, the prototype that you should have in mind is, for example, the two-dimensional Ising model, where you take a lattice, got spins on it, like a square lattice. At each site of the lattice, you've got some spin variable, takes the values, for example, plus or minus 1. You have a probability distribution that the probability of a particular configuration is proportional to e to the minus 1 over kt times some energy which depends on these spins in a certain way. For example, it might be a nearest neighbor interaction and so on. And one of the things that you would like to do in statistical mechanics is to compute the correlation functions That is, you would like to compute expectation values, except in this talk I will be using this to represent expectation values with respect to this probability distribution. And what conformal field theory does is to focus on whether one can make, whether one can give a meaning to objects like this correlation function in the continuum limit, that is, as you draw this mesh on the plane finer and finer, more and more finely. So I'll talk in a few minutes about how we believe this continuum limit works. That's the conformal field theory point of view. The SLE or SLE point of view in general is rather different. It says that let's take a particular configuration where, say, the spins are up or down or so on. The spins that are up form clusters on this lattice. Should use a different color or something. There are clusters of up spins and clusters of down spins. And the boundaries of these clusters form curves on the lattice. And what SLE tries to do is to understand what is the statistics of these curves, once again, in the scaling limit. So can we define a measure on these curves in the scaling limit? So you see that actually it's pretty difficult to give a direct dictionary between the kind of correlation functions of local objects that we would like to understand from the conformal field theory point of view and the kind of objects which are studied from the SLE point of view. Nevertheless, we can try to make an attempt there, and once we've done that, it would be nice to understand, in fact, whether there is a direct correspondence somehow between in the continuum without having to think too much about the lattice model that one is describing. That is, are there objects in the conformal field theory which can be recognized in the SLE picture? And one of the basic objects, which I said earlier, in the two-dimensional conformal field theory is this object called the stress tensor, which plays a fundamental role in conformal field theory. Can we identify it over here? One reason for perhaps for undertaking this program is that conformal field theory, or in fact quantum field theory in general, is a mathematically very ill-defined object. We know how to do calculations. We know how to do perturbative calculations in quantum field theory, but the actual objects, the quantum fields that we're working with are very fuzzy kinds of things that at least for me, it's very hard to actually get hold of and understand what they actually are. And so, of course, there are various approaches to rigorous mathematical approaches to quantum field theory. There is sort of constructive quantum field theory where you actually try to make sense of this program here, where you start from a cutoff field theory and you actually construct these correlation functions. There's a sort of more axiomatic approach where you say, well, we expect that the correlation functions are going to have this property, that property. We're going to impose these as axioms. Fair enough, but then you don't really know whether you're really then you really don't know from this point of view what physical object you're describing. Or maybe because the mathematical postulates behind SLE are in fact minimal. We're going to have a talk about SLE tomorrow, and it will be explained that basically there are two postulates. There's a kind of a Markov property and a conformal in Herring's assumption. And basically, once one puts those in, all the results from SLE follow in a rigorous way. So somehow I would say that SLE is, the basics are mathematically less complicated and the output is more rigorous. And in particular, because the postulates that you have to prove here are rather few, proving that the scaling limit of these curves in these two-dimensional critical models is described by SLE is a simpler task, and in certain cases it has actually been proved, and quite recently, for example, for the two-dimensional Einstein model, it's been claimed to have been proved rigorously. Therefore, we might start to think of SLE as being the mathematically well-founded object, and then try to derive conformal field theory from it. And that is a program which I would like people to think about anyway. What I'll be talking about in the second half of this talk is kind of maybe the first step in that program. I'm certainly mathematically well endowed enough to actually prove all the things that one would need to prove in order to do this, but it's something that I'd like to put out there. Okay, so that's sort of a sketch of where I'm going. So let me talk now a little bit about the scaling limit. So these are, I would say, not expectations, but sort of assumptions about the scaling limit or the continuum limit in conformal field theory, well, in quantum theory in general. So in what way do these lattice correlation functions, which are very well-defined objects, in what way do they approach the correlation functions of a field theory? Well, the basic idea is that there are suitable combinations of lattice observables, which I'm going to call phi lattice, and I'm going to label them by J, and they're going to be localized around some lattice site R, but these are going to be, for example, one object might be the magnetization of the Ising model itself, but another object might be the product of two spins on neighboring links, on neighboring sites, and so on. So there's a whole list of these operators, but there are special linear combinations of these objects that we can make, such that if we look at the correlation functions of these objects on a lattice, so say phi 1, phi 2, lattice R2, etc., all the way up to phi of R of n, and we renormalize these, that is, we So I haven't defined this yet, but I'm going to take my lattice spacing, or my regularization parameter, I'm going to call it A. So I multiply these by suitable powers of A, A to the x1, A to the minus x2, A to the minus xn, and what these x's are depend upon which particular scaling operators I've chosen, but the idea is that the limit as A goes to zero of this object exists, and we think of it as the as a correlation function in the field theory. Okay, so I should say in inverted commas, because once you really for one thing, this actually only makes sense when the points are not coincident. If the points are coincident, then you've got to write it in terms of another operator, another scaling operator. So it's important that Ri is not equal to Rj. So when I write this now, it's no longer really an expectation value of a product of numbers with respect to some measure. Mathematicians use this word morally, that is morally this or morally that, but I never understand it, because what they really mean is that it's immorally that. So basically, this is immorally given by some, we like to think of it as some functional integral over all our fundamental fields in our theory of some product of these things with respect to some action. But really, this doesn't make mathematical sense at all, and what you've really got to do is to go through this limiting procedure. So basically, another way to think about this is that you can think of a quantum field theory as basically a set of correlation functions. Okay, so you can think of this as defining a function C, 1, 2, up to n, of R1 up to Rn. So a correlation function is just a map from, well, we're in R to the D in general. So it's n copies of this thing minus taking out all the coincident points. So it's a map from that into whatever space we want. In general, it might just be a complex number, or it could be an element of a Lie algebra or something. So a more sort of axiomatic perspective on this is that we think of a quantum field theory, or a conformal field theory in general, haven't quite got there, as a set of correlation functions satisfying certain conditions, and in the old days these were called the Whiteman axioms and that kind of thing. So there are equivalent sets of axioms that you can formulate for a conformal field theory. And one of the most important properties or axioms is the idea of the operator product expansion. So this is the idea that these functions, which is a function of n variables, when two of its arguments approach each other, when these when the arguments of these operators get close, it can be expressed as a linear combination of all the correlation functions with n minus one variables. So this is kind of written formally that phi I of R1, phi j of R2 can be written as a sum over k times some function ijk of the difference of these coordinates times another operator psi k evaluated, say, at the midpoint, for example. So this equation, though, only makes sense when substituted into a correlation function. So it's really a statement about correlation functions. But the statement, what gives the statement a lot of power, is that these coefficients here don't depend on whatever else the other objects are in the correlation function. Okay, so they're independent of phi n minus 1, and so on.
Is this an exact equality, or are they arbitrary?
This is an infinite sum, so you've got to make sense of it. For a conformal field theory, which is, at least for a rational conformal field theory, it's a very well-defined object, and in correlation functions, it's a convergent expansion. In a general irrational conformal field theory, or more general quantum field theory, then that convergence, I would say, is not understood. But it's some kind of asymptotic expansion. All the scaling operators of the theory, right? So I haven't told you what they are yet, of course. But this is so. If you're going to have the kind of axiomatic approach, is that you have a list of all operators in the theory, and this k is a sum over all of them here.
Now the choice of the midpoint is somewhat arbitrary.
Oh, that's completely arbitrary, because included in this sum are derivatives of the operators that you've already got. So I can always put this at R1, and I can make a Taylor expansion about R1 or something, including all possible derivatives acting on the operators that I've already got. Okay, so they're included in there.
So the somehow
the choice of the midpoint. Well, you just have to say, I mean, it just swaps the terms around in the sum. No, it doesn't spoil conformal invariance. It just, I mean, yeah, it's true. When you look at the leading terms here, then it doesn't matter whether you take the midpoint or not. Okay. Where was I? Operator product expansion. Okay, so what I haven't told you yet is under what circumstances this scaling limit actually exists. Okay, so the scaling limit, or well, it may exist, but it may be empty. I mean, it may be just that the connected correlation functions vanish whenever R1 is not equal, RI is not equal to RJ. And if you take a general statistical mechanics model, that's what's actually going to happen, because on the lattice, typically you choose a typical temperature for your icing model, the correlation functions decay exponentially on a scale given by the lattice spacing. So if I take the lattice spacing to zero, that means that everything is uncorrelated when I take this scaling limit. Okay, so then you do have a scaling limit, but it's empty. So in order to get something non-empty, you've got to tune the parameters in your original energy functional here such that you're close to a critical point. so you're close to the critical point. And in particular, so you have typically a correlation length in the problem, which tells you the length scale of the exponential decay in general of the correlations. This is proportional to the, or equal to the inverse mass of the theory, if you think of where m is the lowest mass in the theory. In order to get a non-trivial scaling limit, what you've got to do is to keep this fixed as you let the lattice spacing approach zero. If you do that, then and m is finite, non-zero, then you get typically a massive quantum field theory out of this. That's not what we're actually interested in here. We're interested in tuning the parameters so that we're actually at a critical point. Then, which means that we're interested in looking at a massless quantum field theory. In that case, it says that in the field theory, there is no actual length scale. And then, if you think about this limit existing, it tells you that these correlation functions themselves, these correlation functions in the field theory are going to be scale covariant. So it tells you that if you take phi 1 of lambda r1, phi 2 of lambda r2, dot dot dot, phi n of lambda rn, then that's going to be equal to lambda to the minus x1 minus xn of the same thing before you did the rescaling. Okay, so in a sense, the scale invariance or scale covariance of these correlation functions follows from the fact that that you had a renormalizable theory, and that's one of the important links between the renormalization group and this idea of broken scale invariance, anomalous scale invariance. Okay, any questions so far? So now I'm going to start talking about the stress tensor. And I'll start by defining it in a classical theory. So I said that morally or immorally, theoretical physicists like to think of these correlation functions as given by some kind of a functional integral with some action here. But in the classical limit, we just get a classical field theory with a classical action. So let's just talk about that first of all. So one way to define the stress tensor is to put the theory onto a curved background or into a general metric. It doesn't have to be curved necessarily, but we choose a general metric, g mu nu. We write down the action for our theory in this general coordinate system, and one way of defining the stress tensor is that it's the variation of the action with respect to the metric, up to factors of minus signs and various other things. Now, actually, everything that I'm going to be talking about today is actually going to be in flat space, but of course we can still think about having a general coordinate system in flat space. So for example, if we're thinking about making a coordinate transformation, an infinitesimal coordinate transformation like that, then we can easily work out what is the change in the metric. And what we see is that, sort of turning this around, that the change in the action can be written as the integral of this local object, the stress tensor, times d mu alpha nu of r ddr in general, up to factors of 2. And we could, in fact, of course, integrate this by parts. Up to a surface term with a minus sign, and that's how does, in particular, if we're just considering a translation where alpha is a constant, this tells us that in fact t mu nu from this point of view is up to total derivatives equal to the Noether current corresponding to the translational invariants. So T mu nu is the Noether current for translations. So it's conserved. Plus derivatives, plus maybe terms involving derivatives. And actually, the Hayes derivative terms are kind of important in a Lagrangian field theory to getting all this stuff right that I'm going to say, but I'm not going to go into this. You've actually got to consider something called the... Oh, I should say, of course, in this context, it's of course called the energy-momentum tensor. I should have said that, although we're going to refer to it, because we're in Euclidean space, it's more like a stress energy tensor, and then we abbreviate that to stress tensor. So in fact, to do this properly, you've got to consider these terms and talk about what's called the improved energy momentum tensor. But I'm not going to go into these kind of subtleties here. Okay. So just still staying at the classical level. Maybe I didn't want to erase this. Okay. Did someone have a question? Okay.
Maybe I just, what's the connection between D and T in these?
Well, phi is just, these are the degrees of freedom. These are your classical fields. So it could be a scalar field, which I just write down in the general curve background or something. Okay. Okay. Just still staying at the classical level. If we look at this equation here, we see that if we take alpha mu of r to be lambda r nu, that corresponds to a scale transformation, just as I've erased there. And if the action is going to vanish, that's going to happen if the trace of the stress tensor is zero over here. So scale invariance corresponds to the vanishing of the stress tensor, but because of the structure of that equation, it also implies that delta S is zero under a general class of transformations. This is what whenever if the symmetric traceless part of I should have also said that delta S equals zero under rotations means that T mu nu equals T mu nu. This is rotations. So those two things together tell you that it's zero also if the symmetric traceless part of D mu alpha mu nu vanishes. So in fact, classically at least, if you have this equation, it's going to be, the action's going to be invariant under a larger symmetry, which actually corresponds to conformal transformations. And conformal transformations can be thought of as transformations which are locally equivalent to a scale transformation and a rotation. But the amount of rotation and the amount of stretching of scale transformation can depend upon R. And it's the local nature of this equation here, which means that if it's invariant under global scale transformations, it's also going to be invariant under local scale transformations, which are conformal transformations. So this is all classical, of course, and it's a sort of big question as to when you quantize this theory, when you think about the whole quantum field theory, whether these statements are still going to be true or not. So, of course, what happens in many theories, for example, a non-abelian gauge theory in four dimensions, is that the action is classically scale invariant, but when you work out the loop corrections, you find that the theory spontaneously generates a mass, and that so it's not in fact conformally invariant as a quantum field theory. But we're going to assume that we are going to be looking at a quantum field theory. We're going to assume that is not the case. And you can do this actually by going to a non-trivial fixed point of the renormalization group. And then you get this scaling, this anomalous scaling that I talked about earlier. So we want to have sort of some
why you call it anomalous scaling?
Oh, well, actually, in the way that I define it here with these X's, I did not distinguish. But if the theory that you're talking about came from quantizing some classical theory, then the objects in this classical theory would have had canonical scaling dimensions, just naive scaling. Scaling dimensions, and anomalous scaling just means that the actual scaling dimensions are not the same as the ones that you would get naively.
And so the actual exponents there, it doesn't matter what sort of operators you put together for the outcome or not.
Which operators?
Well,
which objects you have?
Right. So
well, it's only for there's a class of operators which are. You know, you can form suitable linear combinations of objects which scale in a simple way. That's all I mean.
No, yeah, I'm sorry. When you look at the anomalous exponents that you get there, does it matter what goes into the correlation function with these exponents, or are they just associated with each of the phis is anomalous exponent?
Yeah, each of the phis has its own exponent. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, one last thing that I should say is the simplification of all of this as to what actually happens in two dimensions. So in D equals 2, we've obviously got coordinates x1 and x2, or x and y if you like. But it's helpful to use something called complex coordinates. And I find that when I talk to mathematicians, this confuses the hell out of them. So it's not confusing at all, but let me just explain it. You define z is x1 plus I, z is x1 plus i2, z bar is x1 minus i2, and you basically treat these as being real linear combinations of the coordinates. So if you have any tensor, you know, t mu nu, for example, you can, using this and closing your eyes to the fact that I is really imaginary, you can form components here. So for example, TZZ would be TXX plus ITXY plus ITYX plus or minus TYY, and so on. Okay? Does that? Okay. And so on. So basically, we're just going to write things in a general basis. Then, hashalize. So basically, that means that you're writing the metric in this form, and your metric tensor is something like 0, a half, like that. Okay, so when you do that, these equations in two dimensions simplify, because it turns out that the symmetry of the stress tensor means that TZZ bar is TZ bar Z, and the tracelessness implies that the sum of these two things is zero. So just
define T.
Yeah, you're right, thank you. Yeah, all right. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yes, thank you. And the conservation, though, so therefore, each of these things is actually zero. And the conservation, when you write it down, then says that dz bar of tzz is zero, and that dz of tz bar z bar is zero. So we call the zz bar component t, and we call the z bar component t bar, and that's just notation. But what it's saying is that classically, and it will turn out to be quantum mechanically too, that these things are holomorphic or anti-holomorphic objects. That is, they only depend upon Z or Z bar. Sorry, I've been away from America for long enough that I just can't call it Z anymore. It's terrible. All right. This was all classical so far. So we want to have an idea of what we want to mean by this in the quantum field theory, and we go back to this kind of immoral equality here. And basically, it's saying that if we make a change in our metric, or then the action is going to change by this small amount here. And so if we want to work out what is the change in a correlation function, what we can do is to expand this small quantity out of the exponential, in which case we have got an extra object in our correlation functions. So the statement is therefore going to be that the change in one of these correlation functions is going to be an integral ddr, in general d alpha mu of r, times our correlation function with an insertion of this t. So this is a sort of classic idea which is called a Ward identity.
Yeah, you restricted it to phi 1 here, it's voluntary, or is it phi n?
By?
The correlations were phi 1 r 1, phi n r n.
This is a general correlation function, I'm sorry. A completely general correlation. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. That was just a misprint. I'm sorry. Sorry, a completely general correlation function. Completely general here. So I have an insertion of T. Okay? Now, so we got this from this immoral perspective, but this is going to be kind of now the quantum, the field theory, the proper field theory definition of T, that it is that object which, when inserted in a correlation function, gives you the change in the correlation function. Okay, so what we're going to have to do in the second half of this talk is, given SLE or something, we are going to want to and identify suitable objects within SLE. We want to identify a suitable object such that this equation is true. Okay, now there's a lot of stuff that goes through now with the operator product expansion and stuff, so I'm going to go through this rather quickly, and perhaps you will see how it works. So so now I'm going to be in two dimensions, and I want to consider what is the, so I have a correlation function at these points r1, r2, rn. I want to consider what is the effect of a conformal transformation, an infinitesimal conformal transformation. Okay? And it's easier if I consider myself as being in the whole complex plane, and of course one of the problems, as you know, with an analytic function is that unless it's a constant, it can't be small everywhere. So I actually have to, so I want to choose the case when alpha corresponds to, I guess one of the things that I haven't said is that a conformal mapping, that is this thing in two dimensions, corresponds to the fact that the does correspond to the fact that the z component of alpha is independent of z bar, so it's an analytic function. Okay, now so I want to make a transformation here. But I'm going to have to, in fact, just restrict it to being in a finite region around these points, because it can't be infinitesimal everywhere. So I'd like it to be such that alpha mu equals zero outside here, and I want to choose a conformal mapping inside here, and I can't sort of quite do that in a totally smooth way. So I've got to have some kind of a transition region here where alpha is not going to be conformal here, but it's going to just go smoothly into zero, or the, so I just have the identity outside, okay? And that means that I'm going to get a contribution to this thing, this object here, precisely from this region here, where the action itself is actually going to change. So the only place that the action is actually going to change is in the region where it's not conformal. But how I can write the change in the action just by integrating by parts as an integral of alpha mu t mu nu ds nu, where this is around the boundary of the inner circle dr1 up to Heinz. So I've just integrated by parts. So what I have is basically that now the change in the correlation function is given by an integral of this object around a boundary outside here. If you write this in terms of complex coordinates, then it comes out much more simply. What you find is that the change in this correlation function can be written as a contour integral of alpha z times t of z times phi 1 up to phi n dz, plus another term which involves t bar, a similar term. And so that immediately tells you that it's not important where I actually put this contour, as long as it runs outside all of these points, because alpha of z is an analytic function and all the correlators of t are as well. All right. So this is another version of the Ward identity. Now I'm going to write this in terms of operator product expansion. So let's see. Let me go back here. So let me choose first of all the case when I have a scale transformation. Okay. Then that corresponds to, in fact, alpha z as being proportional to z itself. Okay. So if this were z here, what do I get on the left-hand side? I guess I erased it a long time ago, but what you basically get is, I guess this is going to sound great on the web page. Anyway, let me put it here. Let me just suppose this is epsilon here, it's infinitesimal. Then the change in this, well, it gets multiplied by what I called lambda, which is now 1 plus epsilon, and then it gets raised to all these scaling dimensions, x1 plus x2 plus xn. Okay, so to first order in epsilon, this is just x1 plus x2 plus xn times the correlation function itself. Okay? So that tells me that in fact, because this is now Z, it tells me that when I take Z close to the argument of this operator, there in fact has to be a double pole whose residue is X1. So it tells me something about the OPE of T with each of these operators, phi j. So it tells me that in fact it has to be something that I call delta j divided by z minus z j squared of phi of j z j z j bar, where this delta j, in the case that I was talking about where all these operators were scalars, under rotations, is just in fact xj over 2. And then I can do the same thing in the case where this thing was a translation, in which case I had a constant here. Under a translation, this basically phi j goes into phi j plus epsilon d by dz of phi j. So it gets added a derivative. And when I look at that, this tells me this, in fact, also has a pole term of order 1, z minus zj, and the coefficient there is 1 times dz of phi j, zj, zj bar. So the conformal word identities tell me something about the structure of the operator product expansion of T with one of these scaling operators. And there are lots more terms here which are regular. But you can ask the question, is there anything else more singular than Z minus ZJ squared? And the answer is, not if phi of j is what's called a primary operator. So no more terms, no more singular terms, if phi j is what's called primary. Okay, so the way this basically works is that all the other things that you get here, less singular terms, are all called the descendants of this primary operator here. So we can actually arrange all these scaling operators of the theory into whole families with a primary operator at the top and all the descendant operators. These actually correspond to the representations of the Virasoro algebra, though as I said, I'm not actually going to enter into this here. So if we have a primary operator, there are no more singular terms here. And that tells you something extremely important, because it tells you that in fact if you consider a completely general conformal transformation, the general alpha of z here, then we know what the singular terms here are as we shrink the contour down, and we're just going to pick those terms up in doing this contour integral. So actually it's going to tell us how each of these objects transforms under a conformal transformation. So basically, that's the story. In order to go to the second part, I just want to write this OPE in a slightly different form, which is that the correlation function of T of Z with phi 1 of Z1, Z1 bar up to phi n of Z2 of Zn, Zn bar is equal to the sum from j equals 1 up to n of delta j z minus z j squared plus 1 over z minus z j d by d z j. This operator, sorry, that's squared, acting on the correlation function without the t in there. And the reason that I wanted to write it that way, which is completely equivalent to this statement, is that it's just a statement about correlation functions. It says that the correlation function of these primary scaling operators with the insertion of a stress tensor is given by this partial differential operator acting on the original correlation function. And this is something which, if we can give meaning to these objects within SLE or something, we can try to actually prove whether it's true or not. And that's going to be what's in the second half. I just wanted to make one more comment, excuse me, which is that T itself is not primary. When you work out the OP of T with itself, then you can in principle get an extra term. You get all the terms that we had
sorry, John.
Before, yeah, yeah.
Just to make it clear. So the OPEs are supposed to be holding within the correlation function.
Yes, yes.
And we plug in the OPE
yes.
to get the qualities of the correlation functions.
Yes, and that's what
happened with the dots on the right hand side of the
because, well, basically, this is a holomorphic function of Z. And you know its behavior at infinity, so it's completely given by its pole structure. Meromorphic function, sorry. Okay, so the dots don't enter here.
Does it imply that this corresponding correlation functions are zero?
Yeah.
Because in principle they should be there, right?
Yes. It actually implies that they're not there. In this, so the correlation function of all this junk with all the other stuff is zero.
Isn't yeah. T determined only after total divergence? From the theorem.
No, that's going back. That's going way back. I've got beyond that now. I'm saying that there is an object called T, which has this property.
Well,
are you asking whether it's unique or not?
Right. The, you know, maybe those terms are there, but that total divergence or something, and that will not be there in any.
No. Well, as long as I put the appropriate boundary conditions on this correlation function as z goes to infinity, it's completely determined by its singularities. Maybe John.
They're regular terms,
yes.
Regular terms are terms of change
in here?
Yes. If you take the terms with J demand only one that you keep
in your. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Yes. Sorry, there are. So if I look around a particular singularity, for example Z1, then there's a double pole with strength delta 1, there's a single pole, and then all the other terms with J not equal to 1 are the regular terms, so it's not. Thank you. But this question of uniqueness is not important at this stage. Okay, so I just wanted to finish by saying because in general the two-point function of this has, there's no reason for it to vanish. It means that you can have, in fact, a term here which is proportional to 1 itself. And because the normalization of the stress tensor is fixed by the Ward identities already, you can't fix this to be 1. It's a number, and this is one way of seeing how the so-called conformal anomaly or central charge of the conformal field theory arises. Okay, so for those of you who came to John Bernard's talk last week, where he started talking about Virasoro algebra and so on, I should say that these equations completely encode everything about the Virasoro algebra, but you have to go to a Hilbert space formulation of the problem, which involves something called radial quantization, which I'm not going to talk about now. So I've already run on a bit for the first half of this talk, but we should take a break for how many minutes?
5 minutes, let's say.
5 minutes, okay. 5 minutes, and then the second section will be slightly more technical. So in the second part of this talk, I want to describe some work which was on trying to identify the stress tensor within SLE type descriptions, and to show that these formal Ward identities are satisfied. And this is work I did in collaboration with Ben Doyon, who is here, and another postdoc, Valentina Riva, who may be here in the program later. But actually, it was inspired by an earlier paper by Friedrich and Werner of Fields Medal fame. So now we're going to be thinking about random planar curves, and we're going to think, as I said earlier, about some kind of an Ising model, for example, and we will be looking at random non-intersecting planar curves, which are the cluster boundaries, for example, in the Ising model or in percolation or in other models, that they might be other Hamler curves. Now, as was realized near the beginning, when mathematicians started thinking about how you think about this is a very hard problem, because you've got very many curves. So one way to get around this, I think, as was explained in the introductory talk last week, is to choose your boundary conditions on your Ising model, so that, for example, they're all up here and they're all down on this part of the boundary, in which case you know there is one curve which connects those two points and ends at the boundary like that. And then what you do in SLE is to not erase these, but not to think about them, and just to think about the measure on that single curve which connects two points on the boundary. So the measure on gamma is described by SLE. Now, there is one particular case where that is all there is, that is, there are no other loops around. So there are no other loops. If we're looking at the problem of self-avoiding walks, so we look at all, well, we start with a lattice, we look at all st- half avoiding walks on that lattice that begin here and end here inside this domain, and we weight them in a suitable way, actually, so that all walks of the same length have the same weight, but there are lots and lots of small ones. You actually also have to weight them by a factor of this non-universal object, non-universal quantity raised to the power of the length. I'm not going to go into that, but there is a measure on the lattice which is believed to be, not proved yet to be, but believed to be scale invariant in the continuum limit. So this corresponds to the self-avoiding walk problem, and it's conjectured to correspond to SLE with kappa equals 8/3. And this obeys a very special property which is called conformal restriction. So let me explain what this is. So in conformal restriction, we can imagine taking our domain D, and we can imagine taking a chunk out of it. Let's call this A, and our endpoints are not in A. Okay, so given the measure on curves in D, this defines what's called the restricted measure on curves in D minus A. So given the measure mu D, we get what's called a restriction measure on gamma in D minus A. That's clear, that you just restrict just to look at those curves which look in D minus A. On the other hand, there's another way that we can get a measure on curves restricted to lie in D minus A, which is to consider a conformal mapping. D minus A is a simply connected region. So a conformal mapping that takes D minus A back into D. Okay, so like that. So it basically gets rid of A, and let's assume that it just keeps the endpoints the same. So then, given a curve here, I get another curve here, which is the image of this curve under this conformal mapping. So the inverse of this mapping, by inverse, goes back from there to there. Given this measure on curves here, induces a measure on curves in D minus A. And I'm just going to say it in words. If the induced measure that we get by this conformal mapping is the same as the restriction measure, then we say that we have conformal restriction for this property. And this is believed that to be a property of the scaling limit of self-avoiding walks, but not in general, for general values of kappa. For example, if we have an Ising model and we do this construction, and let me actually draw my curve here, then there are actually going to be some loops of the Ising model which are going to intersect this region A. Okay? So So the measure on this curve is going to depend on whether this loop here is here or not, and in particular on whether this loop, this green loop, this closed loop, is allowed to enter this region A or not. So if it can't, so if we're just looking at the measure in D minus A, all the closed loops are not allowed to enter A either, and therefore the measure on gamma is definitely going to change when we do that. So in general, for things like the Ising model, we don't expect this this conformal restriction property, the way that I've stated it here at least, to actually hold. So that's why we're actually
when it falls to, you have to actually readjust where the
input. Well, as long as I did it in the half plane, I could always do a conformal map so that the origin and the infinity stayed the same. And so, right. So in fact, I know that I can do it here as well, because I can always conformally map back from the half plane. So I can always choose a conformal map phi such that these two endpoints stay the same. Okay. The reason that I want to consider this conformal restriction property is that I somehow want to identify T as being a property of the curve, okay? Because that's within SLE, that's all that we know about. If there's all this other junk around, then I expect the stress tensor to know about all this other junk as well. And the reason is that the stress tensor in a quantum field theory couples to everything in the theory. Okay? So if I don't know about these loops, if I only know about the curve itself, then I'm not going to be able to say very much about the stress tensor yet in theories which have got lots of loops around. So most of what I'm going to say now is just going to be restricted to theories which actually satisfy the conformal restriction property, where all the matter in the theory is just on the curve itself. So one way to think about these curves, sorry David, and this is C equals zero, because there's no matter there, basically. I mean, or there's just one particle. Okay, so for SLE kappa, yes. Now there are other variants of SLE which do satisfy conformal restriction, like SLE kappa rows, and other measures on closed loops, for example, which I hope will hear about later in this workshop, because they're, you know, I mean, people talk about SLE now, but basically SLE is old hat as far as I understand, and people are working on other things, so I hope Scott and others are going to explain these new things to us. Anyway, in the case of SLE kappa, then it's only valid when kappa equals 8/3, and that's the result of Lawler, Schramm and Werner. Anyway, where was I? Yes, so the motivation for this is, so the physics motivation goes back to the idea that the stress tensor is the energy momentum tensor, more or less, and that measures the flow of energy and momentum in the theory. And basically, from a field theory point of view, these loops are nothing but the world lines of particles in the theory.
I just have a question about the C equals zero statement. Are there conformal field theories or conspiring SLEs that satisfy restriction but don't have central charge?
Yes. And Scott's going to talk about them sometime, I hope. Yeah. But they satisfy restriction in a slightly different sense. And so you've got a sort of qualify a little bit what you mean by restriction. Okay. Okay, so the idea is these are like particles, so they basically carry energy momentum. So one way that we can think about, I mean, if this were a fluid or something, right? So these are just the streamlines of a fluid or something, particles. So one way that we would think about the stress tensor of this fluid is that we would make a little, we would make some little window in the fluid, some kind of slit or some kind of thing. We would measure the total energy momentum flowing across this, and let's call it P mu, the total energy momentum flowing across. This would just be the integral of T mu nu, sorry, ds mu, where this is ds mu is the normal vector. Okay. So, I mean, in a fluid where everything was nice and regular, this would be what we meant by the energy, the momentum tensor, or the stress tensor. So this sort of inspires us to think that the way that we might try to define in SLE the stress tensor is that we put a little observation window in there, and we just measure the energy momentum flow across it. So, well, that would be fine if the curve were nice and smooth and a differentiable curve, but the problem is this curve is a fractal. So on some kind of scale, it's doing all kinds of stuff there. So it's a little bit hard to think about the energy momentum carried by a fractal curve. However, maybe that doesn't matter too much, because one of the great things about a conformal field theory is that the energy momentum, the stress tensor, couples to everything in the theory. That is, I can take almost any observable in the theory, and there is some component of the stress tensor in there. So in particular, one thing that I'm going to do, and what we will do, is that we're going to take this little window. It's going to be centered on a point Z, it's going to have a length epsilon, and it's going to be at some angle to the axis, to a fixed axis. And we're going to ask just what is the probability that the curve even intersects this window. Okay, so in this case it intersects this window, and more generally though it might do, for example, that, and it still intersects the window. You could say that in this case, well, it doesn't actually go through the window, but it intersects it. It turns out that it doesn't matter all that much whether you ask whether it goes through the window or whether it actually just hits it at least once. Okay? So we're going to look at the probability, which is going to be a function of Z and epsilon and theta, which is the expectation value of the indicator function. This is sort of math notation, that the intersection of the curve with the window is not empty. Okay. So it hits the window. Now, you can pretty well convince yourself that's finite. And in general, in fact, if you think about how this behaves at fixed theta, then it's as epsilon goes to zero, then this actually tells you something about the fractal dimension of the curve.
Sorry, the E means an expectation value?
Yeah, expectation value with respect to the SLE measure. Okay, which I haven't told you what it is yet, because we have to wait until tomorrow, really, to find what it is. But anyway, let's assume that we know this. Okay, so as epsilon goes to zero, we actually expect this probability to go to zero, like something proportional to the fractal dimension of the curve. So I'm not going to explain that, but those of you who are familiar with thinking about the fractal,
I think it's 2 minus df.
Thank you. It's the scaling dimension of the energy operator in the theory. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Time's, of course, a function of z. In general, a function of z and z bar. And theta. But if I average over theta, so in fact, in fact, if I average over theta, that's even nicer, and I get something that looks like this. This object, though I'm not going to talk about it much, is going to correspond to one of the scaling operators of the conformal field theory. So this is at least one way of constructing this one. So we look at expectation values. Keep going a little bit. Let's suppose that we have lots and lots of slits. Let's suppose we have 2 slits, and we look at the joint probability that the curve hits these 2 points, and we scale in the same way. We average over all the angles here. We average over all the angles here. Then we get something which scales like this epsilon to the 2 minus df, this epsilon to the 2 minus df. We end up, if this is z1 and z2, we end up with a correlation function which depends upon z1 bar and z2 and z2 bar. And this is precisely within the conformal field theory, the scaling dimension of a particular operator, which is called the energy density operator. We haven't proved that. But from the I said operators, but I've been using the word scaling operators all along. They're not operators because this is just a Euclidean field theory. Okay. Of a particular operator which we think of as the
so 0, 1 and plus 2.
Sorry?
Why 0, 1 and plus
2? It doesn't have to be. Yes, it happens to be in the CATS table for this particular theory, but I could do it for some other theory and it wouldn't be in the CATS table. I mean, it's a scaling dimension of it's a certain conformal field in the conformal field theory. I'm now going to define another conformal field by a disk. Yes, absolutely, yes. Sure. Well, I'm going to at the next stage, because I want to construct something which is not the energy operator but the stress tensor. Yes?
There should be some phi 2-1 fields corresponding to the beginning ending of the curve. That's when the curve.
Yes, this is conditioned on these points, right? So it's. Maybe someone else is going to explain this later. Okay. I didn't really want to. Okay. Okay. So within the conformal field theory, we also have to have special fields here which create and destroy your curve, and you have to normalize it with phi phi. However, I want to talk about the stress tensor, and the aspect of the stress tensor is that it's not a scalar operator, but it has non-zero, what's called non-zero conformal spin. And we could actually see this already from the, well, it's the ZZ component of T mu nu, so that under a rotation, Z goes to Z, e to the I theta, this thing goes into e to the minus 2 I theta times TZZ. That's under a global rotation. So we say that it has spin 2. So what we want to do out of this object is to construct not a scalar operator, but an operator of spin 2. So the way that we do that is that we take this probability and we take a certain Fourier component of it, which is this thing. So one way to think about it is that it's, so if I take my curve and I take a slit that looks like this, and I take the same curve and I look at a slit that looks like this, then this would be counted with a phase plus 1, this would be counted with a phase minus 1. So it's the probability that the curve goes through this way minus the probability that it goes through that way, or intersects that way. Okay, so this is an object with the right spin. And then I think it's time to quote our theorem. Which says that if you take the Hess object, P epsilon z of theta, d theta, e to the minus 2 I theta, or rather, okay. Yeah, so this as it stands is just a number. The claim is that as epsilon goes to zero, this scales like epsilon squared. So I'm going to scale it by epsilon to the minus 2. Then the claim is this object exists, this limit exists, and it can be identified. And there's an 8 over pi, is it, Ben, or some number here?
Yes.
Okay, and it can be identified as the same object as I defined over here, which is the correlation, the insertion of a stress tensor into the SLE, which means that because I've got these operators, which let me call this point W1 and this point W2, phi of W1, phi of W2, divided by phi of W1, phi of W2. And what I mean by this object is precisely the thing that I would calculate by using the conformal word identity, which I wrote down earlier. That is, this thing is precisely given by the thing which has got a double pole. So it has some delta phi over W minus W1 squared plus 1 over W minus W1 d by dW1, and the same thing with W2 acting on phi of W1 phi of W2. Okay. And moreover, you can do this many, many times. That is, you can look at the curve going through many, many slits. You can look at the indicator function that the curve goes through the slit, you can take the appropriate spin 2 Fourier component, scale it with epsilon to the minus 2, and you will have these multiple insertions of T, and they are all going to satisfy the conformal word. Right, so that's interesting. Maybe I could just leave that until the end. Yeah, but remind me. Okay, so let me just give you, because we're running very rapidly out of time, just a brief sketch of the proof, because I'm not going to even get near actually showing it to you. So we have to use conformal restrictions to actually do this. For what? No, this is for anything satisfying this conformal restriction. It's not proved that self-avoiding walks satisfy conformal restriction. Okay, so this is okay.
Is there a way to generalize it to theories that don't satisfy conformal?
Yeah, I'll briefly mention that at the end. Okay. That's work in progress, but yeah, sure.
It doesn't need to pass through the point Z1 and Z2.
Where's Z1 and Z2? The ends of the slit?
No, the one inside. I mean, the cam is rotating, right?
So it starts at W1 and ends at W2.
Then you have Z1 and Z2 inside.
Ah!
It doesn't go through Z1 and Z2 necessarily.
No. Okay. So I just mentioned some observables here. Okay. These are the observables just that it begins and ends at W1 and W2. I can have other observables that the curve passes to the right of this point. That's an observable, which I can put into here. Let me call this O of Z1. Okay. This is the indicator function that it passes to the right of Z1. So this is a zero-dimensional conformal field, but we still get the same Ward identities with this conformal dimension being zero, for example. Did that answer your question? Okay, I guess I'm getting a bit rushed. So let me just give you an idea of how the proof goes without too much complication. So actually it's easier to do this in the upper half plane, so we've got our curve starting from zero and going up to infinity, and we've got so we're interested in saying something about the stress tensor at point Z, and let me call it Z0 now, otherwise I'll get too confused. So what we do is that we actually, instead of taking a slit here, let's actually take a disk of radius epsilon. Okay, and then we've got all our other slits around, all the other events that it passes to the right or left of these things. Okay, and okay, we're interested in the probability that it goes through that disk, which of course is basically 1 minus the probability that had it avoids that disk, okay? And that's where the conformal restriction comes in. Because we're now restricting the curve to avoid the disk. Now, what we can now do is to make a conformal mapping. This is at the point Z0. Conformal restriction works in a multiply connected region as well. It just works in a slightly more complicated way than what I'd say. Okay, I'm not going to explain it, but it does. So as long as you, okay. So basically, we can make a conformal mapping, which is basically z goes to z plus epsilon squared over z minus z zero plus some regular terms, which are need to be put in there just to make sure that the real axis is invariant. Okay, so what this conformal mapping does in the neighborhood of Z0, it's very singular, but of course Z0 is outside our region, so that's okay. What it does is actually map this disk, and there's an e to the 2i theta here, into a slit. Okay, so it collapses this down so that the outside of this is the outside of this slit. Okay, of length approximately epsilon and angle theta. So epsilon is small here. Okay, so what it does to the other points and the other slits is it just moves them around a little bit in a predictable way. Because epsilon is small, it only moves the ham around in a certain way, and so the effect of doing this on the probabilities of going to the left or right of this or going through these slits can just be expressed in terms of simple differential operators acting on the arguments of these other objects. What we have here, though, the probability of avoiding this disk using conformal restriction can be expressed in terms of the probability of avoiding the slit, and then turned into the probability of intersecting the slit. So we get a relation, which I'm not going to write down because it would take me too long, but we have an equation for the probability that it intersects the slit, and in particular how it depends upon theta through this conformal mapping, in terms of differential operators acting on the coordinates of all the other points. We then just do this integral e to the minus 2i theta d theta, and when we do that we get the result I've written there. Okay. Any questions about that? You get the general form of the Ward identities. Yeah. Of the conformal with C equals zero. With no central charge there.
I just want to clarify the epsilon and minus 2 that you applied to the epsilon, because as you said, the probability will decay slightly slower than...
Yes, but so this component of the probability, though, the claim is that it decays like epsilon squared.
So somehow, since you integrate it against e to the minus 2i theta, that term in the expansion will just integrate to zero.
Yes, so there's a term in here which is independent of... of theta, which goes like epsilon to the 2 minus the fractal dimension, which is slower than this, but that gets integrated out when you take that Fourier component.
What is the resolution of the measure?
Of the measure on the curve.
You have to do the calculation.
You know, because of conformal restriction, you know how the measure on the curve changes when you make this conformal transformation, so it has a very definite, so it's known.
But you don't want to write it
down? No. Okay. I'm happy to discuss it privately. Okay, so there were a couple of questions. One was about what happens for other values of the spin. Okay, so if I take so instead of taking 2 here, let's suppose I define an object e to the minus i P theta times this, and I ask, well, so in general, this is going to define for me some operator in the conformal field theory, which in general is dependent upon Z0 and Z0 bar, whose correlation functions depend on that. You can ask, when is it holomorphic? When does it only depend upon Z0 rather than Z0 bar? So the answer is, for P equals 2, it's holomorphic only when kappa equals 8/3. Okay, so in general, this construction does not give us a holomorphic stress tensor, a holomorphic object, when there are other loops around in the theory, which of course makes sense because the stress tensor knows about all the other loops as well. So we could do this calculation for, well, we can't quite. Well, you can actually, you don't have to do conformal restriction. If you just look at the probability that the curve goes through one slit, okay, so just a simple SLE kappa, you can work out how does the probability that it goes through just a single slit. That problem you can solve using the SLE equation. And it's a standard calculation in SLE. So you can ask, how does this depend upon Z0 and Z0 bar? And the answer is, if the spin is 2, then it's holomorphic. That is, only depends upon Z0 if kappa equals 8/3. In general, however, for arbitrary values of the spin 8,
yes.
You can't remember?
Well, yeah.
No, that can't be right. P plus 3?
8 over N plus 1.
No. 8 over P plus 1, thank you. All right. Is that right? Yes. Okay, so if we put P equals 1, so we want a current in the theory, just a regular current, like an electric current, then we have kappa equals 4. And those are well known to, those are, as Scott has shown, these are the level lines of Gaussian free field theory. So the current d mu, epsilon mu d mu phi, going around those level lines is the conserved holomorphic current there. If you put P equals 1/2 and you're looking at holomorphic fermions, then you get kappa equals 16 over 3, which is the value of kappa corresponding to the Ising model. And this is the object that Smirnov has discussed in his recent proof that the Ising model converges to SLE 16 over 3. For P equals 1/2. And so on.
Why don't you get, oh, I see, because you said you so far only expect the longer works for P.
Well, we can't establish the Ward identities corresponding to this.
For the case where P equals 1 holomorphic, you can establish the Ward identities for
the using some. Let's see. I haven't thought about that. You would have to use some other method.
So now, can you compute correlation functions for the SLE path using explicitly?
No, you can. I'm just talking. I'm not talking about it going through multiple slits, right? Only in the case of conformal restriction can we compute probabilities that it goes through multiple slits.
But in the conformal restriction case, we can't.
We can compute it for this component of, sorry, for the spin 2 components, because that's the stress tensor, not for the other spin components. But for the spin 2 components, they're holomorphic functions of the Zs. So they're given entirely by their pole structure, so you know them exactly.
So,
So if I take lots and lots of slits and I spin them, then I take the spin two components. Yes, and I ask. The Fourier components. That depends on all these Zs. And the answer is a meromorphic function of all the Zs that I can write down explicitly.
Okay, so that's in the probabilistic statement about...
Yes. But even in conformal field theory, I don't know how to write down... So if it were the spin zero component, and then I'm just looking at the probability it avoids these or goes through lots of disks, then I don't know the explicit answer to that. Though in principle I know that the differential equations it satisfies, but in principle, you know, I can't write it down. Okay.
Can you find the W current in the model that way? Because
no, it doesn't.
Is two, and apparently it's equal to minus two.
It doesn't seem to work. This formula doesn't seem to work for anything. You know, so no. To get larger values of the spin, wouldn't you have to have smaller values of kappa? Yeah, it wouldn't work. So somebody asked the question about what happens if C is not zero. So, well, I can only tell you what my expectations are from conformal field theory there. So now in this case, we've got lots and lots of loops, okay? And I can look at a slit, and, yes? And this came from pure SLE. Yes. This has nothing to do with, yes. This is a separate calculation.
Why in cases that are not zero? You can't have more than just one spin.
Well, I mean, in these cases, the stress tensor will be holomorphic, but the stress tensor isn't this object because it knows about everything else as well. This object is the... Well, yes, I mean, this is really a separate seminar, but if you look at the FK representation of the Ising model, then you've got... So you take your boundary conditions to be fixed here and free here. Then you've got this curve, which is the boundary of the cluster connected to here and the boundary of the cluster. As well as this, you've got all sorts of closed things. This is on the lattice, right? Now, if you look at the standard literature definition of the fermion of the Ising model, which is the product of the spin operator and the disorder operator, and you ask where is the expectation value of the fermion non-zero, it's non-zero exactly on this curve. Okay, and it's so the fermion is the indicator function that the point on the lattice Z here is on gamma, okay, multiplied by a phase factor, which is e to the I theta over 2, where theta is the amount of winding that you have to do in order to get to this point, because in general it doesn't look like that, it looks like that or something. And this object which depends upon Z is an object which is lattice holomorphic. It satisfies the lattice version, the expectation value of this. The expectation value here is a that satisfies the lattice version of the Cauchy-Riemann equations. And if you can then prove that they converge to the continuum Cauchy-Riemann equations, as Smirnov claims to have done, you can then prove that this curve in the Ising model converges to SLE 16 over 3. Anyway, I think that was taking me just a little bit off my... Okay, so in this case, if we now look at our window, we've got all sorts of stuff going through it. So now here's our window, and there's lots of curves going through it. And now I'm really going to look at curves that go through it. Actually, it turns out that that's not going to count now, so I'm not quite sure. You know, it's slightly different from what I was saying. There are calculations that you can... let me call this Z1 and Z2. Let me think about the number of curves that go through there, which is a random variable. There are expectations from conformal field theory that actually in the scaling limit this is actually logarithmically divergent. That is because there are lots of very, very small loops that just go around here. So this thing actually diverges like this thing divided by the lattice spacing. So what I've got to do is to subtract this thing off in a certain number here. So I take this object, and so I take this object, and I take essentially the spin 2 variant of this thing. It's not quite right. I haven't quite defined it right. But then it turns out that this is more or less appears to be a good definition of the stress tensor, in the sense that I can prove that, or not prove, I can show from conformal field theory that if you take the expectation value of this object and you make a conformal mapping which changes the boundary, this thing changes according to this something which involves the central charge times the Schwarzian derivative of your transformation. So those of you who know about conformal field theory will recognize this. So this is all very much sort of what you might expect in a field theory. You sort of look at some observable, but you have to regulate it. You know, you've got to regulate it. You've got to subtract something off. And it's the fact that the regulator is not conformally invariant that leads you to the conformal anomaly. And it's precisely this term which leads you to the conformal anomaly here. So I think I better stop now. Unless there was someone else's question which I didn't answer. Yes, so that works. So yes, it's actually very important that when I look at T and T, that I get a 2 here. That this 8 over pi actually fixes that 2. But then it doesn't fix the scaling dimension of phi. You actually calculate the scaling dimension of phi, and it turns out to be 5/8 or whatever it's supposed to be. So it's a non-trivial check. At C equals 0. Yeah. And C equals... Yeah, you don't get any C term in this case. Right, I think I've talked for quite long enough. Thank you.
Thank you.